So Genesis 19, 20, and 21 are all kind of related, because what's really happening here is you're seeing people's sins come to the surface. So throughout Genesis, we've seen Abraham, we've seen Sarah, we've seen Hagar, we've seen Lot, and they've been blowing it in a lot of areas of their lives. They've been sinning a lot. And what's happening in 19, 20, and 21 is the fruit of all that they've been sowing is coming out. That's what's happening right now. And what happened with Lot is he was hanging out in Sodom and Gomorrah for a while, and he was sinning so hardcore that he legitimately was willing to sacrifice his own daughters to be raped to death just to preserve his own sinful lifestyle. And we see just how far that dude had fallen, that how far that guy had come from God. And God ended up judging Sodom and Gomorrah. He saved Lot, but Lot was so ashamed about what he did, he never went back to his uncle Abraham. He just went to a cave, and he ended up getting drunk all the time, and his own daughters ended up having sex with him. And from those unions came the Moabites and the Ammonites, who became two of the greatest enemies of Israel. So Lot just totally bailed hardcore. Now we're going to shift sequences, and we're going to see how Abraham, how Sarah, how Hagar are going to be confronted with their sins, and we're going to see the difference. Okay, because here's the deal. Even though we're Christians, even though we believe in God and we have forgiveness for our sins, God forgives you for your sins. If you sin in Christ, He forgives you for your sins. However, you will still have consequences for your sins. Right? There's nothing in Christianity that says that if I sin, God will preserve me from the consequences of sins. In fact, it would be a very loveless thing for God to do that. Can you guys think of why? What's that? You never learn, right? I mean, a good parent definitely loves their kids no matter what, but they definitely allow consequences to happen when they mess up so the kid learns from it, right? You want the person to learn from their mistakes, or else they're just going to keep doing the same thing. And actually, in 20 and 21, the funny thing is that chapters 20 and 21 have already happened. This is a cycle, right? When I start talking about chapter 20, you guys will see what I mean. But this is not anything new. They're just repeating old habits, and they're watching destruction happen as a result. So chapter 20 begins like this. It says that, "And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now Abraham said to Sarah, his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah." Now this is an exact repeat of something that happened earlier in Abraham's life. The only difference is, back in chapter 14, he went to Egypt. Now he's going to Gerar. Now, those of you guys who have been with us, where is Abraham supposed to stay? Where is he supposed to be? What's that? Israel, that's right. Good job, Emily. He was supposed to stay in Israel. That was the land that God promised to him and his descendants. And he leaves Israel, and he goes to this place called Kadesh and Shur, which today would be around Saudi Arabia, kind of deal. That's where he kind of went, to the Arabian Peninsula. And it never says in Genesis 20 why he does this. Earlier on in the book, he went to Egypt because a famine happened in Israel, and so he was scared and he went to Egypt. It did show a lack of trust in God, but at least he had a reason. Now he's leaving for no reason whatsoever. And the only thing we can really surmise behind this, and behind a lot of his behavior that we're going to see in chapters 20 and 21, is that he's upset with God. He's upset with God, and he's kind of backsliding a little bit. Can you guys think of a reason of why he would be upset with God, given what I just told you about Lot and all that stuff? Who is Lot to Abraham? This is his nephew, right? And if you remember, in Genesis 18, Abraham spent all of Genesis 18 trying to save Lot. He was sitting before God, and he's like, "Hey, if you find 50 people in Sodom and Gomorrah, would you spare it?" And God says, "Yep." He says, "How about 40? And he goes all the way down to 10. God goes into Sodom and Gomorrah. You know what? He didn't even find 10 people. And he destroyed Sodom. He destroyed Gomorrah. And Abraham can see it. Does that make sense? He could see Sodom and Gomorrah from where he was living. And he saw it get destroyed. Now, does he have any idea that Lot's still alive? No, he has no clue. Lot ran away. He's living in a cave now. So there's a lot of evidence from what's happening in chapters 20 and 21 that Abraham's a little bit upset with God and the way that God handled things. And there's a possibility that he's just like, "Man, well, God, why would you do that? you know, why would you destroy the city? Why would you do these things? I don't understand. And so he's kind of fleeing away from what God had for him. And this is just a good thing for us to understand as Christians. The reason why most people backslide. Do you guys know what backsliding is, by the way? Right? It's you're pursuing God, you're moving close to him, and then all of a sudden you slide back into your old habits. You start going away from God. The reason why most people backslide is not because they go to college and they hear about evolution for the first time. It's not because they hear about inconsistencies in the Bible for the first time. Because logical questions like that, they could be answered. If you guys have questions like that, I encourage you to ask me, ask Tom, ask any of us. And we'll happily help you guys. We won't give you answers, but we'll help you guys to research those things for yourself so that you know why our faith is consistent. However, the reason why most people start doubting their faith is because they're upset with God. Something's happened in their life where they just don't trust God anymore. For me in my life, the reason why I started to doubt God, the reason why I started to distrust him is because there was things that I wanted to do, namely sinful things with my sexuality that I wanted to do, and I knew that God said I couldn't. And so because I got upset with God that he made those rules for me, I left him. Other people, they get upset with God because of something like what's going on in Abraham's life. Maybe someone in their family dies. Maybe someone in the family gets sick. Maybe they get sick. Maybe something drastic happens to them and to the health. So they start doubting God, and so they start backsliding. But ultimately, you could always kind of trace it back to this point that something has happened in your life that you don't trust God. Something has happened that you don't believe in him. And so you start backsliding. You start going back into your old habits. And that's exactly what Abraham's doing. He's repeating what he's already tried and failed to do. And not only does he leave the town, but he does exactly what he did when he went to Egypt. When he went to Egypt, he told his wife Sarah, he says, hey, pretend to be my sister. Pretend to be my sister, because if you're my sister, you're let's face it, you're really pretty. If you're my wife, people are going to kill me, and they're going to take you anyway. So just pretend to be my sister. They're going to take you. They're going to rape you, but they'll take care of me because you're my sister, and that's what we're going to do. So you see that he's totally backslid. He's totally gone back into his old ways of living, which is tragic. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing because, like I said, it's just a complete repeat of what already happened, but this is what happens. Sarah must have been one of the most beautiful women that's ever lived, because you guys know how old she is in chapter 20? She's in her 90s. She's in her 90s, and this king sees her, and he is so turned on by her, he takes her. So she must have been, like, stinking immortally beautiful, man. just like flawless, you know? And there's no tummy tucks and facelifts in that day. She's just naturally just this gorgeous woman. I don't know what she was doing. She was doing something right. Because to still be that attractive at 90 is... that's impressive, all right? So she attracts the king himself, and he takes her into his little harem, and he's going to have sex with her. But then God visits him, and he says, like, dude, if you do it, you're a dead man. And he's like, Lord, I didn't know. And God's like, I know you didn't know, but just so you know, I'm going to kill you if you touch her. And so of course, he wakes up the next day, and he's like, hey, Abraham, what the heck did you do to me, man? You said that she was your sister. And I like Abraham's response because it does show you, once again, it shows you a little bit of his heart of why he's doing the things that he's doing. Verse 11, Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. But indeed, she truly is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is your kindness that you should do for me in every place, wherever we go. Say of me, he is my brother. Now, what is the correct answer to that question? Abraham, why did you do this? You lied to me. You put me and my entire kingdom in jeopardy. By the way, at the end of the chapter, it mentions that God heals these people. And whatever he did to them, he gave them some hardcore disease where they couldn't have kids. And beyond them not being able to have kids, clearly they knew something happened to them. Something happened to their anatomy where they knew immediately, we can't have kids. What was it? I have no clue. But it was hardcore enough to make them freak out like this. All right? So what's the correct answer? He comes to Abraham, why would you do this to me? What should have Abraham said? Because I was scared. It's my fault. It's no one else's fault. I was wrong, right? That was what he had to say. What did he say instead? It's your fault. It's God's fault. It's my wife's fault, right? That's what he does. He's like, dude, first of all, you people are godless, right? Secondly, my wife's pretty. That's her fault, right? So she's got to act like she's my sister. And she kind of is my sister, right? He's like, she's my half-sister, so it's kind of kosher that way, you know? So I didn't lie, you know? And thirdly, God made me wander everywhere. You know, he kicked me out of my home. I was happy in my city. I was hanging out with my family. Now my dad's dead. Now my uncle, my nephew's dead. Now I'm alone, right? You see how he's just blaming everybody else? Okay. What this shows when someone's backsliding, first off, let me just lay it out this way. If you backslide enough that non-believers are correcting you, you're in bad shape. Right? If my atheist friends come up to me and say, Peter, what are you doing? You know, I'm like, oh man, like I've really gone a far distance, right? I am really in bad shape if even atheists are looking at my life and saying, like, you are messing up. Like that, you know you're hardcore in sin at that point. He's got non-believers, he's got pagan people looking at him and saying, Abraham, what the heck are you doing? Beyond that, when we try to justify our sinful behavior, it shows that we're not actually sorry about what we did. Does that make sense? If he was actually sorry about what he did, he would say sorry. But if you notice in everything that he's saying, he doesn't apologize once. He doesn't say sorry. There's not even anything close to sorry in here. There's not a my bad. There's not a, dude, I messed up. There's none of that. There's your fault, God's fault, my wife's fault. That's what's going on in my life. This is good for us to know, not only in self-inflection, when we look at our own lives and we see, if you notice that you're sinning and you're being called out, do you feel sorry about it? Do you have the ability to just say, you know what, I messed up? Do you have the ability to do that? That's good for self-inflection, but it's also good for to look at other people as well. Right? If you want to know if someone's really serious about changing, listen to the way that they apologize. Because people could apologize and not really be sorry about what they did. Does that make sense? You'd be like, hey, dude, why'd you do that? Oh, man, you know, like my life, you know, stuff's going on. You just don't know, you know, and I'm, you know, that was, I'm sorry that you feel sorry about what I did, but, you know, that's what's going on. You know, they would say something like that, but they can't just go, hey, you know what, I blew it. I was wrong. Can you forgive me? That kind of thing. Right? If you don't hear an actual apology come out of someone's mouth, they're not serious about changing. You know, they're not even close. Abraham's not serious about changing. He's not close at all. The amazing thing about the story, the most amazing thing to me about this story, is that God blesses Abraham in multiple ways. First off, this king pays Abraham money. He gives him money because he's like, dude, God is going to jack me up, so I'm going to be nice to you. I don't want to be nice to you, but I'm going to be nice to you because your God threatened me and I'm scared, so here you go. And he gives him money. He lets him take any land he wants in the land. Then, in the very next chapter, God gives Abraham the son that he promised Abraham in the beginning. Now, is this the point in Abraham's life where Isaac should be born? Right? Is this the point where you're like, oh yeah, Abraham's firing all cylinders. Right? It's time for the miracle, man. It's time for the miracle to happen. Abraham's doing everything right. Let's get the miracle child out, man. No, he is blowing it in every conceivable way. Now, why do you think God is treating Abraham this way? Why is he blessing him? God is demonstrating to Abraham how his love works. His love is not dependent on our action. It's dependent on who God is. Right? He just loves us. And I love that God does that, by the way. It's crazy to me. All the times that I've looked at my life where I've backslidden, like pretty hardcore, I could always see how God has like protected me and helped me and preserved me and reached out to me during those times. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty radical. I would think that those would be the times that God would throw up his hands and be done with me. But he demonstrates to me that he loves me. That's one reason. The other reason is actually it's told to us in one of the Proverbs. And it's a good proverb for us to learn. It says, be good to those who are evil to you, and in doing so you will heap coals on their head. Okay? This is what it's saying. If I blow it, like hardcore in front of somebody, And they look at me and they say, like, dude, Peter, you screwed up. I hate you. You're lame and everything like that. In a weird way, I want that response because then I could kind of justify what I did in my own heart. Does that make sense? So, like, if I hurt Ian and I'm like, you know, let's say I'm driving down the road and, you know, let's say I just run into his car and then I flee, I drive away. He finds me and he's like, dude, you freaking suck. I can't believe you did this. Now in my heart, a weird part of me would be happy that he did that. Because I'd be like, man, that's right, that dude's a jerk, you know? I'm kind of glad I hit his car, you know? And, yeah, I'll pay him the money, but, man, what a D-bag, you know? And I'll be kind of angry and upset. But if he, like, tracks me down and he finds me and he's like, Peter, dude, I love you, man. And what's going on in your life that you would hit me and run? You know, like, why are you doing this? You know, I'd be like, it would infuriate me even more because I'm like, dude, why are you so nice? You know, like, you should be mad at me. You should be angry at me. Why are you doing nice things to me? This doesn't make any sense. And it would kind of, like, infuriate me. And that was exactly what happened in my relationship with God, where, like, I was doing all these evil things to God, and all I received from him was love. And it infuriated me. I was like, God, why don't you judge me? You know, that's always the idea that I had when I was your guys' age, was that, like, if I sinned, I always expected God to, like, you know, punish me, like something bad was going to happen. But then good things happened. And I was like, what's going on? You know, what kind of God is this that he would just forgive and love me no matter what? And it just really did infuriate me. Now, the reason why I said it's a good proverb for us is if you really want to piss somebody off that's a jerk to you, you know what you could do? Be good to them. You know, because if you're mean to them, they'll just justify their meanness towards you. They're like, man, I'm glad I oppressed that guy, you know, because he sucks, you know, and he's just a jerk and he's belligerent, right? If you've got a boss that's just like always like, you know, being a jerk to you and you're a jerk back, you'd be like, that's right. I got to keep them in line. I got to do this. But if your boss is a jerk to you and you're an exemplary employee, he'll just feel like a jerk. He's like, dude, I suck. Like, I can't. Why am I like this? You know, it to put it another way. It makes people think about their own sin. Because as long as they could blame the world, as long as Abraham could blame God and blame his wife and blame the country, dude, he gets his way. But everybody proves him wrong. He looks at the king and says, you're godless. Who's the only person listening to God in this scenario? Is it Abraham? No, the king listened to God. Abraham didn't. Okay, he blames his wife. What did his wife do? She submitted to him. He blames God. What did God do? He blessed him, right? So now Abraham has to, all of his excuses are kind of falling apart. Do you guys see that? Where he's got no one to blame now, but who? Himself. He's got no one to blame but himself. He's got to take a long, hard look at the way he's living his life. And this is just kind of precursor to, like I said, to God really shining the spotlight, to putting a mirror in front of Abraham's face and showing him exactly what kind of person he is, which is going to happen in the next chapter. But this is a good like kind of chapter to show us exactly what God is about. Now, the most insane part of this story is that God actually uses Abraham in the end. See, so the healing of this guy, this king, and his people came from Abraham praying for them. Which is another, like, really funny thing to me. Because you tend to think about people who have healing powers, you know, like you know, the when you're reading in the Bible about people that are like laying hands on people and they're getting healed, you're like, man, those people must be like so holy. They must be so insanely holy for God to do that. You know, I've prayed over people, no one's been healed. Man, maybe I'm not holy enough. How holy is Abraham at this moment? Dude, he doesn't just heal one person. Who does he heal? A nation. Dude, he heals an entire nation for praying to God. Isn't that radical? This dude is backslidden. He's a jerk. He's sinning. He's messing up. Yeah, I mean, if anyone should have been the healer, it should not have been Abraham. And even when we look at the New Testament, the people that God uses to heal, we're like, should he have really used that guy? Should he have really used this dude to heal? No way. You know, there's absolutely no way God should have done it, but he does it. And it just shows us that God gives gifts to people as he wills. It's not based on what we do. It's based on how God desires to use people. You know, it's just for his glory. It's for his purposes. Now, the next interesting thing about this, if you guys go down to verse 16, this is the king. This is Abimelech. By the way, the reason why we run into all these Abimelechs, if you guys ever wondered, they're not the same person. Abimelech literally means son of a king. So it's like the Mesopotamian way of saying prince. That's why it's not really, you know, it is a name, but it's the name means something. It's why all the kings name their sons Abimelech. You know, that's why it's all popular. It's like the Bob of the day, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, in verse 16, he says, he's talking to Sarah, and he says, "Behold, I have given your brother." I bet there was so much venom when he said that. "I've given your brother," you know, not your husband, your brother, 1,000 pieces of silver. "Indeed, this vindicates you before all who are with you and before everybody." Thus she was rebuked. Now, this is an interesting part, right? It says that she was rebuked. And you're looking at this like, what did Sarah do wrong? I mean, she submitted to her husband, right? And in fact, the first time this happened when they went down to Egypt and she submitted to Abraham, she was actually blessed. That God actually looked at her and said, "You did the right thing." You know, so she was actually glorified in a way because she submitted to her husband. But now in chapter 20, it's wrong for her to submit to Abraham. And it says that she was rebuked. Why is it wrong for her to submit here and not before? You guys think? She already knew what happened before. Do you guys get that? It's not like the first time she submitted to her husband, there could have been an excuse, right? She could have been like, "Well, maybe he knows what he's doing, and I trust God, and we're just going to do this, and it's going to be okay." This has already happened before. To submit to somebody in the same exact way, knowing the outcome, is not loving, it's not submissive, it's not good. It's actually enabling. Do you guys understand that? Okay, that's why a lot of times, you know, like when you got a marriage, we've been talking a lot about Abraham and Sarah's marriage. When you have a marriage that's falling apart, even if I look at the husband and I say, you know what, the husband's really messing up in a lot of ways. At a certain point, I got to look at the wife. I got to look at the wife and say, like, well, what have you done? Right, like, and she's just like, "Well, I've just been loving him, you know, I'm staying with him." You know, like a good example of this is I'm counseling a couple right now, and this guy's viewed porn, he's gotten prostitutes, he's cheated on her, he's done all sorts of terrible things inside their marriage, and this is repeated offenses. This is not something that he's done once, it's something he's done multiple times. And the obvious question that I'd have to ask the wife is like, you know, why do you keep staying with this person? And she's like, "Well, I'm loving him." Now, is that really love? Is that really love? No, right? Now, let's get down a little bit deeper. Why is she staying with him? There's a nifty word. You guys might learn it. It's called codependent. You guys ever heard that word before? Now, what does it mean? She's dependent on him. To put it another way, she doesn't know how to exist without him. She doesn't know how to function without her husband. And so she is so afraid. She is so afraid of losing that relationship that she's even willing to validate his sin in order to stay with him. Do you guys understand that? Sarah is so codependent on her husband that she's willing to validate. I mean, why didn't at any point did she look at her husband and be like, "Hey, you know what? We've tried this before. Spoiler alert, right? Didn't work out last time. You know, maybe we should probably not do this." You know, she at any point in time she could have said that, but she's like, "No, I'm being," and she probably justified in her mind. She's like, "No, I'm being the good wife. I'm supposed to submit. I'm supposed to say that I'm just supposed to validate him and submit to him. That's what I'm supposed to do." Is that submission? It's a type of submission. It's not a godly one though. Right, now, wives are supposed to submit to their husbands, right? But there is a way to submit. Okay, you know who the greatest example of submission is in the Bible? You guys know? It's the answer to pretty much every question about the Bible. Jesus, right? Whenever I ask about a person, 9 times out of 10, just it's like in history class. You say Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, you get it right, right? You know, like it's going to be one of the questions, right? So Jesus is the greatest example of submission. When you read the Gospels, you actually see how Jesus submitted. Now, he didn't just submit to God. He became a man, which means that he submitted to his parents, submitted to the government, he submitted to the rulers. Now, sometimes when you look at his submission, you're like, "That's not submission." Let me give you an example. One time, his mom was a little bit peeved about his ministry. And she came with his bros, and they went, he was teaching a sermon, and she was standing outside the room, and she's like, dude, you've lost your mind, you need to come home. And this is how Jesus submitted to her. He didn't say, yes, mom, you know, and like left, and he's like, you know, you're right, and I'm sorry. That's not how he submitted. You know how he submitted? He's like, dude, these are my brothers. These are my mothers, those who listen to me and those who do what I ask. Right? He didn't do what she said because by doing what she said, he would be validating her sin. You guys get that? Other times his submission looked like flipping over tables, right? He went into the temple and he flipped over tables and he whipped people in the face. And you're like, dude, how is that submitting? You know, like he's totally making a wreck out of it. I mean, that's not submission. Well, it is. It is submission because Jesus submitted to who first? God. He submitted to God first, and he says, the best way I could love you guys and submit to you is not by validating your sin, but by pointing it out. Do you guys understand that? Does the Bible say to honor your father and mother? Yeah, and you should. You should honor your father and mother. Does that mean validating their sin? Does that mean if your dad's an alcoholic, you just go like, hey, dad, it's great that you're an alcoholic. I love you, you know, and I'm always there for you. Is that submissive? No, right? You girls, when you get married one day and your husband abuses you, is it submissive to be like, no, that's cool. My husband knows what he's doing. He's a leader of the house, man, and I'm totally good with this. You know, is that submissive? No, right? Being submissive means that you give respect. There's a way to rebel, right? There's a way to put it. But it means to also speak up. It means to speak your mind. Okay, so for certain, right, it would be wrong. Let me give you an example of my life where I have to submit. I have bosses in my life, right? Beau's my boss. I have elders over me, right? Now, if I disagree with what they're saying, I'm supposed to be respectful to them, and I'm supposed to submit to them. But that doesn't mean I can't speak my mind. There's just a way that I do it, right? I don't go in front of Beau when everybody's looking and go, hey, Beau, you're screwing up, you know? And I start calling him out in front of everybody, right? Would that be respectful? No. Would that be submissive? No, right? That would be wrong. That would be incorrect of me. But I could pull someone aside, just me and them, and say, hey, man, like, I don't know if this is the right thing to do. Because, and then I give my reasons. You guys understand that? So for a wife to just start nagging her husband in front of everybody, is that good? There he goes again, calling me a sister. You know, this is lame. I know how this is going to go. Is that a good thing to do? No, right? But she could have at any point pulled him aside and be like, hey, husband, let's think this through. You know, why are you doing this? What do you think is going to happen? You know how God dealt with this last time. You guys get that? And she should have, but she didn't. Another thing about codependent people is they find it very difficult to speak their mind. You know why? They're scared of rejection. They're so terrified of rejection that they would rather just hold it in, and they call it holiness. Does that make sense? They call it holiness. They think they're doing righteous things, but they're not. Sarah is rebuked here. You guys get that? She's rebuked by a pagan king. And that's very important. So both Abraham and Sarah are called out on their junk in this chapter. But it gets worse. Chapter 21 is really when things come to a head. All right, so let's get to chapter 21. And the Lord visited Sarah, and he said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. When Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. And she also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, for I have borne him a son in his old age. Now, Isaac's name literally means laughter, means to laugh. And the reason why God said that was actually kind of a rebuke, because when God told both Abraham and Sarah that they were going to have a son, they both laughed. They're like, but it wasn't like a joyous laugh. It wasn't like, God, you're awesome. You know, that wasn't the type of laugh. It was more like a, come on, you know, that's not going to happen. It was like, it was a mocking kind of laugh. And so God says, you're going to name him Isaac. So whenever you look at him, whenever you call your son, you're going to remember how you doubted me and how I was right. You know, that was the reason of why he had them name him Isaac. But now Sarah is actually seeing the joy in it, though. She's like, man, like, dude, I'm laughing because, dude, my son is born and I'm going to nurse him and God is faithful. Right? So you'd think that, like, every single time they saw their son, it would just be a constant reminder of how they failed. But it was actually a constant reminder of God's what? Faithfulness. Right? So that's the beautiful thing, how God turned it around. But notice what happens immediately. Verse 8. So the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham had a great feast on the same day Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. But God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he is your seed. So Abraham is still kind of, you can tell he's still kind of struggling with his relationship with God, but he is obedient to God at this point. And I'll talk about that in a second. But here's what I meant when I said that their sin is coming back to them. In Genesis chapter 16, Abraham and Sarah came up with a plan. They came up with a scheme to try to help God along. We'll put it that way. We'll put it in the nicest possible terms, right? They're like, dude, God promised his son. He's not coming through. So Sarah's like, hey, I got this bondwoman. I got this slave who's, you know, she's young. She's vibrant. Have sex with her. Have a kid through her. And that's how we're going to have a kid, right? Great plan, right? Now, obviously, now that they have a kid, do you see the tension that's building? Okay, because we know that Hagar having sex with Abraham impacted her. Where she, like, you know, once again, we like to believe as a culture that you could have sex without consequences, you could have sex without intimacy, and that's what we could do. We just use our sexuality however we want. Hagar had an intimate experience with Abraham, and she started to build maybe not an infatuation or any type of affection for him, but she definitely felt like she deserved to be with him. She's like, man, I've had sex with this guy. I have a kid with him. Right? That's very binding things to happen to somebody. And all the while, she's the slave, and she's having to watch this other woman have sex with this guy. And it's tearing her apart on the inside. And so eventually, she started becoming resentful towards Sarah. And then Sarah started beating her. So it's like everybody's acting just so cruddy. And she ended up leaving, but then God called her to stay. But now, right, in the back of her head, there could have been this thing where she, the whole time she was thinking like, well, Sarah hasn't had kids. Sarah hasn't had kids. I had a kid. God's on my side. He's not on her side. So she could have been kind of validating herself that way. But now guess what? Sarah's got a kid. And now it's challenging her validation. It's challenging her worth. Ishmael's a teenager at this point. Right? He's around 14, 15. He's a little threatened. Because up until this point, it's just been him and Abraham. It's been him and his dad. But now he's got this half-brother, Isaac. And he knows that kid is supposed to be the promised child. So he's getting resentful. And he's mocking him. Says it doesn't necessarily mean he was just like, like snickering. He could have been taunting him. Or doing something like that. He could have been like messing with this little kid. Like kind of beating on him a little bit. And Sarah sees this and she realizes, this isn't going to work. This is not going to work, Abraham. You got to get them out of there. And Abraham gets very upset because he's like, dude, that's my boy. You know, I'm not going to throw my son out. Notice he's still not concerned about who? Hagar, the girl he had sex with, the girl he used. Right? He's not concerned about her. Right? And neither is Sarah, by the way. They're both just thinking about themselves. But God comes to Abraham and he says, dude, no, you got to do this. You got to let her go out. Now, why do you think God allows this to happen? Why doesn't he say, like, no, you guys need to learn to get along? And you guys need to learn to get along. You need to sit. I'm gonna have this time. We're gonna really work on the problems. We're gonna learn to be a loving family unit. No matter how dysfunctional we are, we're gonna learn how to be a loving family unit. Why do you think he doesn't say that? Look, there's the ideal. We call in the Christian life, there's the ideal of the way we'd like things to be. But we live in a place called reality. All right, it would be great It'd be absolutely phenomenal if two people that have kids, right, maybe like a divorced couple or something like that, and now they have other spouses, it'd be great if they could all just sit down, break bread, and have an awesome relationship, and there's no tension, and there's no weirdness and jealousy. That'd be amazing. Is that reality, though? No, right? At best, right? At best, when there's a situation like this, where two women have a kid with the same guy, at best, you're going to have a cordial relationship, right? Where, like, you guys can maybe say what's up every now and then. All right, maybe on a Thanksgiving meal you can hang out. But that's best case scenario, right? But there's never going to be a time where these two women could just hang out and, like, go to the mall together. You'd be like, hey, how's Ishmael doing? That's great. You know, Isaac's doing so good, right? But there's that elephant in the room the whole time of, we both had sex with Abraham, and this is awkward, and I used to beat you, and, you know, like, there's all this awkward. You just can't get past it, right? The Bible takes things, doesn't take things as we'd like them to be. The Bible takes things as they are. We live in a very imperfect world. And things like this, decisions like this, have consequences. You can't get around them. God doesn't baby us. God doesn't say, hey, I know you messed up, but you're sorry. You're really sorry, so I'm going to take away all consequences for you, and you could live in this dream world where everyone could just get along and hold hands, and it's going to be wonderful. You know, God would love to do that, but he's not going to, because it doesn't teach you anything. All right, it's one thing to know that you messed up. It's another thing to see your mistakes walking in front of your face every single day. And these people, like I said, these people are, both Sarah and Abraham, they're treating this whole situation with such cavalierness that it's insane. You know, such insensitivity that it's crazy. I mean, I'm sure that you guys have run into people like this that are so insensitive that it's just unbelievable to you. Where, like, someone hurt you, like, in a very deep way, and the next time they see you, they're just like, hey, buddy. Like, how you doing, man? We're good, right? You know, we're good. So everything's cool. And you're just like, in your heart, you're like, dude, do you not care at all about what you did to me? Like, does it not bother you in the slightest that you hurt me? And maybe a big reason of why God is allowing Hagar to leave is because of how unbelievably naive, foolish, and insensitive both Sarah and Abraham are being to her right now. Right? And he's just like, Hagar, you should go. You should get out of here. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a nation, but you should leave. And just to take it one step further, notice what Abraham does. Okay, so God tells him, like, hey, dude, like, send her out. It's okay. I'm going to take care of her. Verse 14, so Abraham rose early in the morning and put a bread and a skin of water, and putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. He's sending her into the desert. How much provision does he give her? A bottle of water and a loaf of bread. That is the lowest amount of provision he could have possibly given her. It's like giving someone a bag of Jack Links, like a Gatorade. And like, hey, dude, good luck, man. Like, you're about to go hike it through the wilderness. You know, it's like, dude, that is so unbelievably insensitive. It's crazy. And you can see just how bitter Abraham is. He's just like, man, this isn't going the way I wanted. God, you're going to take care of her, fine. And he just gives her those things and he lets her leave. Sarah, once again, doesn't even care. Right? At any point, she's going to be like, hey, Abraham, you know, I got to think that maybe some of this is my fault, you know, because I told you to do it and I beat her. And you know. But anyway, you know, and she could have said something like that. Hey, give her a donkey at least. You know, give her a Suburban, you know, or something, you know. She's about to go travel to a new land. Give her something. But he's like, no, she's going to hitchhike. Right, she's going to hitchhike, I'm going to give her a loaf of bread and Gatorade, and she'll be all right. You know, and he just sends her. She doesn't say anything. Abraham doesn't say anything. Do you see how insensitive these people are being? How just unbelievably, they just don't care. They're just letting this happen. And Hagar is just going out in the desert, presumably to her death, right? Unless God intervened, she would have died. It's unbelievable how people can act, how wicked people can act. And it shows us sometimes the most wicked thing that we could do as human beings is not actually sinning against someone, it's our insensitivity towards someone. Right? A lot of times, like a lot of the things that have been done against me in my life, if someone was legitimately sorry about what they did to me, it wouldn't have bothered me that much. Does that make sense? Like, the vast majority of things that have happened to me that have really gotten me angry, right? If the person would have just come up to me later and be like, hey, Peter, I'm sorry. I would have been able to, I'd be like, okay, you know, thanks for saying you're sorry, man. That really means a lot to me. But instead, it's just like they act like it didn't happen or it wasn't a big deal. It just infuriates me. It's like, dude, don't you realize what you've done? Like, that, don't you have a clue of what you've done? One of the greatest prayers that we can pray for ourselves, pray that God shows you the severity of what you've done. Right? Every single one of these things, like I said, their sin is just being thrown in their face. It's being blatantly clear that you guys messed up. You did something wrong. And it's caused this huge division. It's caused Abraham to lose his son. It's caused this poor woman her life. Like, what? Like, at what point are you going to realize the severity of what you've done? They're just not realizing it. One of the best things that we can do is go before God and just ask Him, like, God, can you show me the severity of what I've done? Can you show me how unbelievable the sin is that I've committed? Right? And you know what place Christians go to see that? We go to the cross. Because when you go to the cross, you see two things simultaneously. Right? You see the severity of your sin, but you also see the love of God for you. Simultaneously, right? Because you cannot possibly go to the cross and say, yeah, my sin wasn't that big of a deal. Right? Just cost God his only son. You know, that's not a big deal, is it? Right? It's just the only begotten son of God, you know, full of grace and truth, you know, holy, all life is in him, and he's crucified for my sin. That's not a big deal, right? No, you go to the cross, there's no way you could say it's not a big deal. You know how severe your sin is when you stare at what Jesus did for you. But simultaneously, like I said, you also see the love that God has for you. Right? And here's the deal. Forgiveness without seeing the severity of sin leads to this level of insensitivity. That's what it leads to. However, showing someone the severity of their sin without love leads someone to despair. Right? You can't possibly see the severity of your sin without thinking like, dude, I'm just the worst person that's ever existed and just want to destroy yourself. Right? The only balance that you can find is in Christ, where you say like, dude, God loves me fully, but he also demonstrates fully his justice. And that helps me deal with my issues. That helps me actually grow and develop as a Christian. Right? They're not getting it. At the end of this chapter, Abraham starts to get it, which I think is really cool. But at this point, they ain't getting it. Now let's see what happens to Hagar. Verse 15, and the water in the skin was used up. Go figure. They're wandering through the desert. It's like 130 degrees outside, and they got one bottle of water, and they used it up. How did that happen, right? Between a teenage boy and his mom. It says in verse 16, then she went and sat down across from him at a distance of about a bow shot, however long that is. For she said to herself, let me not see the death of the boy. So she sat opposite him and lifted her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Every single time God has visited Hagar, it's always been an attempt to kind of break the cycles in her life, right? Where it's like, you know, she should have learned the first time, right? She should have learned the first time that, dude, Abraham doesn't really care about you. Sarah doesn't really care about you. You should stop trying to find your value in them. Or she should have learned the first time, but she didn't. She made the same mistake. She was devastated again. She was almost killed again because of the insensitivity of Abraham, right? That's what's going on in her life right now. And every single time God visits her, his reminder to her is, once again, he doesn't just come to her and be like, you suck, Hagar. Why do you keep blowing in this way? But he comes to her and he says, what ails you? Hey, what's going on? Why are you so bummed? Why would you put your faith again in this guy who's clearly a wreck? Right? Why would you go back to him? I mean, God told her to go and submit to the hand of Sarah, for sure, but he didn't say, hey, go back to that family situation and continue to be a cog in that wheel. you know, and continue to put your value in Abraham and continue to think that Abraham's going to do the right thing when he's never going to. Right? He didn't say to do that. And same thing in our lives. The question, I mean, it's so crazy for me when I look at my friends' lives. I even look at my own life, how I make the same mistakes. Right? They're not different. I would love if they were different mistakes. I'm like, yeah, I make different mistakes all the time. No, I make the same mistakes over and over and over again, and the same thing, the same results happen out of them. I don't learn. Right? But God, over and over again, he brings us back to the issue. What's the issue? You're not trusting me. You're not believing in me. You're not putting your faith in me. Right? You're going off against me. You're backsliding because you don't believe in me. And he once again shows and demonstrates his faithfulness to her and to her son. Now, the way that he gets Abraham is really funny. He uses this guy, Abimelech. And I love how he does it. Like, Abimelech comes... I'm not going to read it to you guys, but I'm just going to say. Abimelech comes to him, and Abraham's prospering. And Abimelech comes, he's like, dude, God must be for you. You got a 90-year-old wife, she just had a kid, that's insane. And he's like, and dude, you got all this money, you got all this wealth, your land's expanding, that's incredible. God must be really on your side. So he's like, how about you and I make a covenant, right? We're going to make a covenant that I'm not going to hurt you, you're not going to hurt me, and we're going to be good. And Abraham's like, okay. The second after the covenant happens, someone jacks Abraham's well. Which, in our society, we're like, oh, what's the big deal about that? That's like someone turning off the water to your house, right? That's insane. That's where he gets his water from. Someone jacked his well. And beyond that, in the wilderness, it's not like he stumbled upon a well. But you got to dig that thing. How many of you guys have tried to dig in the desert? Right? It's fun for, like, in a sandbox when you dig, like, an inch, right? Then it's fun. But then once you get past that inch, you hit limestone, right? You hit, like, that hard surface, right? You got to dig through that. Digging a well was tough stuff, right? Abraham dug this well. Someone jacked his well. So he goes to Abimelech. He's like, what gives, dude? Someone jacked my well. And Abimelech, once again, he goes to him. He's like, Abraham, dude, like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Right? Just because I'm king doesn't mean I know what everybody in the kingdom is doing at all times. And, like, I'm aware of it and I'm commanding everyone. He's like, dude, why are you coming to me? Why are you upset? Why don't you go to that person and talk to them about it? And Abraham, he like, calms down. He realizes, like, yeah, I'm repeating my patterns. What's Abraham's pattern? To blame, right? To blame people. And so Abraham realizes it. He's like, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. And he grabs 7 ewe lambs, which are female lambs, and he cuts them in half to make a severe covenant between this guy. And he says, dude, like, dude, we're going to be in such a covenant with one another that, like, dude, these lambs, if we violate it, let us be like these lambs. Let us be cut in half, right? That's what people on that day did. And he makes his covenant with his guy. But he immediately, when he does that, you see something click in his brain. Right? Where did this happen before in Abraham's life? Where did animals get cut in half and people walk down the aisle together? Where did that happen? You guys remember? It was in Genesis 15 when God made a covenant with Abraham. So in the midst of Abraham failing, God, again, he reminds Abraham of his faithfulness. And it says, at the end, it says in verse 32, thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech arose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. This tamarisk tree, this terebinth tree thing, every single time God meets Abraham, he plants one of these. I don't know why. It's like... It's his plant. I don't know. Like, he plants one of these things, and he prays to God. I've never seen one. Maybe it's like it looks really cool. I don't know. But he just keeps planting these things, and he keeps reminding himself of God. And I think there's a reason why he does it. I think the first time, I don't know why he did it the first time, but I think every single time after that, the reason why he did it is he's going back to the beginning of his relationship with God. And he's reminding himself of God's faithfulness to him. A lot of times when we backslide in our relationship with God, we would like to just, like, pick things up where we left off and be like, oh, man, you know, I made a mistake in this one area, but I'm just going to keep going with God. But it doesn't work, right? Because then what happens in our lives is if you backslide, and I've done this so many times, I could tell you guys this is exactly what happens. You will fall into a legalistic relationship with God where you blow with God and you're like, oh, man, I made a mistake with God. I'm going to make things right, and then I'll have a good relationship with God again. And what ends up happening is, like, you blow it, you try to do good things, and God still feels distant, and you still feel away from him, and you still don't feel him, and you're like, maybe I'm not doing enough, and it kind of freaks you out. And at some point, if you want to renew that intimacy with God, you got to remember the beginning. You got to think back to when you first got saved. And let me put it this way to you guys. I don't know a single Christian who, when they first got saved, had a shallow relationship with God. You guys understand that? Whenever I love running into new believers, because new believers got this fire, they got this passion. They're like, dude, God's amazing. I read the whole New Testament in one night. You know, it was incredible. But then I talk to a Christian who's been there for like 20 years. And I'm like, dude, like, what are you doing in your relationship with God? They're like, oh, I don't even know, man. I haven't really picked up my Bible in a while, you know. But, you know, I haven't sinned in a while either, so that's good. You know, like, that's how they define their Christianity, their religion. I'm like, this is radical. You know, what happened to you? What happened to your passion? Right? And spoiler alert for those of you guys who haven't been in any long-term relationships, that's the same thing that happens in a marriage. Right? I don't have to tell newlyweds to, like, love each other. Right? You go to a newlywed who are in the honeymoon phase, be like, dude, you gotta like, love each other, man. You gotta, like, do good things, and you gotta, like, you know, have fun, and you gotta buy her, like, presents, and you gotta, like, love him. And I never have to tell him that. I gotta tell people who've been married for 15 years that, though. Right? Because we forget. We really do. We grow cold, we grow dead, and it's so good. Just go back to the beginning, man. It's so simple, right? That's all God says. Just go back to, just do the things. What happened is you stopped doing the original things. You started thinking that those things aren't important when they are. Right? The basics never cease to become foundational. Right? For you guys, when you get married, there's never going to be a time in marriage where you're like, oh, I don't have to tell my wife I love her anymore because she knows. I've said it like a bajillion times. You know, like, how many times do I have to say it, right? You ladies, there's never going to be a time where you wake up and be like, dude, I don't need to, like, really, you know, look up to my husband and treat him with respect anymore because, you know, he knows. He knows I respect. He knows. Right? There's never a time where the foundations, where the building blocks cease to be important. And the same thing is true in your relationship with God. There's never a time where the foundations and the building blocks of Christianity cease to be important. If you hear the gospel that Jesus died for your sins and you're like, yeah, I know that, you're making the mistake, right? You're making the same mistake as the dude who's been married for 20 years where you think it's not a big deal. Right? It never ceases to be important, and we always need to go back to the original, our original relationship with God. Right? So that's just something to keep in mind. Okay? But let's pray. If you guys have any questions, you could certainly ask them. Dear God, I want to thank you for your word, for Abraham's life. And I pray that if we're going through a period like Abraham, like where we're backsliding and where consequences are happening, Lord, please convict us. Help us to go back to our original relationship with you, to remember your love and your faithfulness, God, and to walk forward from these things, Lord. And if that's not happening in our life, I pray that we would have the wisdom to continue to pursue you with faithfulness and love you no matter what. And in your name, amen.